Running a business is hard enough. Don't make it harder with a dozen apps that don't talk to each other. One for sales, another for inventory, a separate one for accounting. That's software overload. Odoo is the all-in-one platform that replaces them all. CRM, accounting, inventory, e-commerce, HR. Fully integrated, easy to use, and built to grow with your business. Thousands have already made the switch. Why not you? Try Odoo for free at odoo.com. That's odoo.com.
Life gets messy. Spills, stains, and kid chaos. But with Anabe, cleaning up is easy. Our sofas are fully machine washable, inside and out, so you never have to stress about messes again. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics, that means fewer stains and more peace of mind. Designed for real life, our sofas feature changeable fabric covers, allowing you to refresh your style anytime. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa effortlessly. Perfect for cozy apartments or spacious homes. Plus, they're earth-friendly and built to last. That's why over 200,000 happy customers have made the switch. Get early access to Black Friday pricing right now. Sofas start at just $699. Visit washablesofas.com now and bring home a sofa made for life. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Let's talk with Anna Glavinsky.
We're going to be talking now about Margaret Thatcher, who loomed very, very large. And I'm really interested to hear more about her life. And we've got the perfect person, Charles Moore, who has written the authorised biography. Charles, hello, good morning. Thanks for joining us
today.
Good
morning. Nice to see you and hear you.
So why did you decide to write this book and bring it out now?
Well, originally, she herself asked me to do it many, many years ago. And I could got access, therefore, to her and her family and close friends and to all her papers. This was nearly 30 years ago now. And I produced the book, which could only appear after her death, in three volumes. And now it's the centenary of her birth just coming up. And what I've done is condense the three volumes into one volume, because not everybody wants to read three volumes. I do understand, fascinating as the subject is. And so this is a shorter version, but still a very substantial biography of her as a politician, of course, as a leader, but also as a woman, and her private life and her own thoughts and so on.
And so she asked you personally to write that book. How did you feel being given that sort of honour, as it were, being trusted with that?
Much honoured and, of course, terrified. I've never worked so hard on anything because it's an absolutely massive subject, because she was the busiest prime minister we've ever had and the longest serving in the era of universal suffrage. She was 11 and a half years prime minister and continuously. And so you can imagine the amount of paper you have to study, the amount of people I interviewed 600 people for the book, the amount of documentation and so on you need to get through is stupefying. And what that shows is how incredibly much she did. And I find her a very fascinating subject because, and in some ways one comes back to the basic, most obvious point, that she was the first and at that time really the only woman of importance in British politics, and the first, arguably the first, not quite the first woman prime minister in the world, but the first important woman prime minister in the world. In my view, that made a massive difference to how she saw everything, how she did everything. It accounted for some of her difficulties and many of her successes.
And obviously,
it makes it a much more interesting story than the average, or indeed even distinguished, male politician.
Oh, absolutely. And my next question was going to be that obviously you did meet her, but how well did you know her, and how much did your understanding of her as a person change as you did all these years of research?
I knew her well. I was never her intimate, but we were on friendly terms, and I saw quite a lot of her both before she asked me to write the book and afterwards. And of course, I was, as I am now, I was a journalist throughout that period, and so I knew the people involved, and that made it much easier to build up all the contacts and so on. I was editing the Daily Telegraph at the time when she asked me, so I was super busy, but I left that job in order to get on with the book in 2003 while continuing as a writing journalist. So that allowed me to get into it. What did I learn about her? Well, some things that she'd said about herself are basically true, but there were some things she said less about. So it was true that she's a conviction politician. That's very famous, and she was constantly preaching her ideas. But what she concealed was she was also a very cunning and pragmatic politician, because any old fool can be a conviction politician in the sense that they can say, I think this, I think that. But the question is, how do you persuade other people of that? And how do you actually get something done? And I think what's very interesting about her is her combination of these strong principles with a real determination to do something. And therefore, she would be pretty cunning about when to do it, when not to do it, when to hold back, when to move forward. And that's why she won three general elections on the trot. The British voters never all thought, or even the majority never thought, we love her. What they thought is, she is formidable, and she knows what she's doing, and she's a much, much stronger than the alternatives.
Mm, absolutely. But so would you say that that changed as you were doing your research, your view of her?
My understanding of her, yes, well, my understanding of her cunning developed. And of course, she would never admit her own cunning, which is in itself a cunning thing to do, because if you say I'm cunning, people sort of start to suspect you. The other thing that came out very much through this personal acquaintance with her is an odd mixture of her very formidable and alarming persona, which could make her seem harsh, and her very kind, a sort of almost cozy life in private. Mm. What I mean by that is that she was horrible to her cabinet colleagues. She was horrible to a lot of big people, as it were, but very, very nice to the people below her, if you like, the people who served her, the secretaries, the policemen, the doorman, security. She demanded loyalty, and if she was given loyalty, she returned it. And therefore forged very long relationships. And it's very fascinating because, you know, if you were her Chancellor of the Exchequer or Foreign Secretary or something, you had a pretty bloody time because she was always telling you off. But if you were her diary secretary or something like that, which was very demanding, she would be very, very nice to you. She'd know about your family and children. She'd send you home if you were ill. You know, she gave people presents. She even used to cook the meals sometimes while she was Prime Minister. So it's a very different... That never really came out, but it's a very striking aspect of her character, I think.
Yeah, I think it's really telling, actually, because you can see so much of a person, you know, the person who they are on the inside by how they treat the people that are serving them rather than necessarily their peers. So it's really interesting. And what about, I suspect many of our listeners and the people reading the book will be interested in her relationship with some of the larger-than-life figures. You know, from Nelson Mandela, the Queen, other politicians. Yes. Can you tell us some of the more interesting stories about some of the people that she met that are in your book?
Well, when she on Nelson Mandela, just a silly story, really. They met. She campaigned very. In fact, funnily enough, she was the first British Prime Minister to demand his release. Though she was much more sympathetic than most to the white South African government, in the sense that she was looking for peaceful change, and she didn't want sanctions. But she, one of her big demands was the release of Mandela, and she started that very early on. When he was released, he came to see her, and they had a good conversation, and a very long conversation. And so long was it that the press outside No. 10 Downing Street all started to chant, "Free Nelson Mandela," which, of course, had been the chant when he was in prison. The relationship with the Queen is very interesting. First of all, neither of them was used to working with a woman in that type of situation, and neither was very easy about it, I think. And they were very similar in the sense that they were only born 1 year apart, but of course very different types of character. And you often see, if you watch The Crown or something like that, what often gets depicted is an antagonistic relationship between the Queen and Mrs. Thatcher, with Mrs. Thatcher lecturing the Queen. Actually, this is almost precisely the opposite of the case. I don't mean that the Queen was lecturing Mrs. Thatcher. What I mean is that if anything, Mrs. Thatcher was too deferential to the Queen. She was too much thinking, I'm the grocer's daughter, she's the Queen, and worrying very much about what she was wearing, for example. She was terribly anxious about wearing the right thing and curtsying very low and so on. And that made it rather difficult for them to establish a close relationship. And the Queen would sometimes complain to people close to her that Mrs. Thatcher spoke to her as if she was sort of almost reciting a list of actions that were taking place rather than having a conversation. And I think that was to do with Mrs. Thatcher's nervousness. But there was a tremendous mutual respect. And when Mrs. Thatcher was pushed out of office, the Queen immediately gave her the Order of Merit, which is the highest, one of the two highest honours she can give, and which is her personal honour. And she did something else, which the Queen had not done for any of her previous prime ministers, which was to attend her 70th birthday party and her 80th birthday party and, above all, her funeral. And the Queen's only attended the funeral of all her prime ministers, of Winston Churchill and Margaret Thatcher. So that showed her recognition that, the Queen's recognition that this was a very remarkable story.
Very remarkable story, remarkable person. And what about her legacy? How much of it lives on today? Like I say, I was a kid when Margaret Thatcher was in power, but you know, you're talking about feminism, sexism, and do you feel like she paved a way for women of the future generations to have positions of power? Or do you think was just a standalone figure in that?
No, I think she very much did, but her method of doing it was a rather unusual one, which was that she thought it weakened the case of women if you kept talking about women.
Yeah.
What you had to do was do it rather than say it. And so she's sometimes accused of not advancing women, and it's true that she almost never had a woman in her cabinet. But it's also true that she changed the whole idea of what a woman could do, because this was the first time that that a woman really was in command in an executive position in a major country, in the key executive position in a major country. And she didn't believe in the equality of the sexes, Mrs. Thatcher. She believed in the superiority of women, but she preferred the company of men. And this is a rather sort of interesting paradox. And I think she adored walking into the cabinet room, and there were 20 men she could boss around, you know. It made her sort of get up in the morning. And I think one can understand that. she said once, I'll explain why I think the woman power was so important to her politics. She said, men always blind you with jargon, particularly on economic matters. Women experience the reality about money problems. They have to manage the household budget and so on. They recognize inflation when it comes. They think about what it means to their family. And this was very good popular politics as well as strong economics. At one time, she was speaking at some dinner of a think tank, and there were tons of speeches before her, and she got very fed up. And when she finally appeared, she said, well, I've just listened to 6 speeches by men, and all I want to say is that the cocks may crow, but the hen lays the eggs. And that was her approach, and she did lay a lot of eggs.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so maybe another one of those as well, which I think is perhaps she's less remembered for, but it's highly topical today, is that she was one of the early leaders to take climate change seriously.
Yes.
Where does she get, you know, why did she believe that? And where do you think that she would think that we're at today with it?
I'm glad you brought it up, and it's quite true. And one of her skills was that she continued long into office to think about new things. Often prime ministers get too tired to do that. So quite late in her period, 1988, she made this speech, which was the first major speech by a world leader about climate change, and essentially enunciating the theory of climate change. And the answer to your question is her inquiring mind, and particularly the fact that not only was she the first woman prime minister, but she was the first prime minister with a science degree. So she had actually understood this. She'd studied. Once she heard about the idea, she started to study it, and she understood it, and she could expound it. And I think that's part of her sort of originality, if you like. And I never answer the what would she do now questions, because I don't know the answer. But though she did strongly believe in the theory of climate change, she also was very against green policies which would make people poorer. So she was very worried about you know, let's say increasing energy costs or high taxation in order to bring about certain things. And of course, the phrase net zero didn't exist in her time. And this idea of putting a timetable on all of this of a very strict kind was something that she didn't want to do.
And the feeling that I'm getting from you as you talk is definitely one of admiration. Would you say that that's true? And is that the feeling that will come across in the book? Do you have criticisms in there as well? And how do you balance that in your writing?
Yes, I do admire her because I think she's very, very remarkable. But I don't have a sort of dog in the fight. I'm not a member of the Conservative Party. I didn't work for her. I'm a journalist and historian. And I just think it's the key thing about her is that it's very, very interesting and important. People sometimes say she was divisive, and she certainly could be. But the most striking characteristic of her time was she was very successful. And by that, I don't mean that all her policies were right. Some of them were very wrong, such as the poll tax, for example. But she worked out what she wanted to do, and she did it. And she did it for a long time because she was capable of winning elections. So that sort of definition of political success, and I think that too is very interesting and very relevant to now, because it's absolutely not true now. So we've now had about 10 years in Britain where nobody's really been able to hold on to power, and we keep changing prime ministers without even having an election. We've now got a prime minister with an enormous majority, but already very, very weak politically, very weak. I just think that contrast is very remarkable. So I always feel sort of, sometimes I thought when I was writing this book, oh, this is impossible. There's so much. How am I ever going to climb this mountain or build this building? But then I never got bored. That's the thing. I got frightened, but not bored. And that remains the case. So I'm a keen preacher for my own, not for her, but for her story.
And how does that book read? You say you've got a mammoth amount of information, a huge number of interviews. What's it like for the actual reader to get their hands on it and consume that information?
Well, I hope you get very close to her, and I hope you get a full understanding of how the politics of the time worked and the people of the time and what mattered. And what I've done in this centenary version is I tried to put in masses and masses of citations because I was the first person to see all these records. And I tried to have bits of evidence and counter evidence at every point. And I slimmed that all down. So while keeping what I think is the essential structure. So I think this is a better book for the general reader and a less good book for the scholar. But I hope it's enjoyable because, you know, it is a damn good tale. And if it's not enjoyable, by the way, that's my fault.
I'm sure it is. I mean, this book has been a huge part of your life now for so long. Now that you've got this centenary edition out the way, are you packing it up, putting the story behind you, moving on to new things, or what's next for you?
I don't think I want to write another book about Margaret Thatcher. I do a great many talks, and I do a gig which I enjoy, which is with a colleague in which she acts Mrs. Thatcher and I act the other people, and we do the last 3 days of her time in office. It's a sort of whodunit come tragedy of those last 3 days and the plot against her. So I enjoy that, but I think I've done the historical research I need to do, and time for me to very soon to do something else. But remember, I'm a full-time journalist anyway, so I'm constantly overworked. So I'm not looking desperately for some new project.
If you could just let us know how we can find out about the tour and the gigs that you do. That sounds really interesting before I give all the details about the book.
Yes, thank you. Well, we do it on invitation. I don't sort of advertise it, but we do it mainly for charity or students or whatever. It's just an enjoyable sort of 50-minute semi-dramatization. By the way, you said you were a kid when Mrs. Thatcher was there. An interesting thing which showed the effect of her power, and you might have been a relevant person in this because of your age. When she fell from office suddenly, a friend of mine's daughter, young daughter, said to him, "Daddy, in Britain, can a man be prime minister?"
Wow.
Which showed the dominance that she'd achieved.
That is a great note to end this on. Thank you for sharing that. And Charles, thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. So that was Charles Moore there. And the book out for him is The Margaret Thatcher, the authorised biography, single volume, centenary edition. And you can find that on Amazon, pop it into Google, or of course, find it on the Talk Radio Europe bookshop.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Owning a home is full of surprises. Some wonderful, some not so much. And when something breaks, it can feel like the whole day unravels. That's why HomeServe exists. For as little as $4.99 a month, you'll always have someone to call. A trusted professional ready to help, bringing peace of mind to 4.5 million homeowners nationwide. For plans starting at just $4.99 a month, go to HomeServe.com. That's HomeServe.com. Not available everywhere. Most plans range between $4.99 to $11.99 a month your first year. Terms apply on covered repairs.
With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made to last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.